try again.
Torah Resource presents The Rob and Caleb Show.
All aboard!
And now, from two sides of the same state, here they are, Rob and Caleb.
Oh, what up? Shalom, and welcome to the Rob and Caleb Show. My name is Caleb Hegg, and with me, as always, my friend, my teacher, my mentor, Rob Van Hoff. What up, Rob?
Hi, Caleb. Shalom.
How's it going?
Going well.
Yeah, you. I hear you guys have some snow over there.
Yes.
And
it's
as
like 0 degrees right now with the wind chill, maybe even below.
And as everyone knows, I'm sure, Rob and I are celebrating the Seahawks win of the Super Bowl here.
Booyah.
In the United States. If you don't know, then crawl out from under your rock. The Seahawks have won the Super Bowl, crushing, and dominating the Denver Broncos.
You know, it's crazy. Like, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager,
mm-hmm.
you know, and even younger, like when I was in grade school, I was a big Seahawk fan in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And I, you know, Zorn and Largent, you know, I thought these guys are great. You know, never would I have imagined the Seahawks going to Super Bowl. And now, like, my kids and my nephews who are all into sports, they're growing up in a world
where the Seahawks have won the Super Bowl.
Yeah. And not only won, but like you said, like crushed it.
Yeah.
And it's
oh, yeah.
like, that it's a different world. We live in a different world than we did a week ago.
Everything has changed. Everything like, is different. The prophecies can come true now.
Well, now that, let me see, Sharon has
uh-huh.
died.
Yeah.
Seahawks won the Super Bowl.
Hey, it's time.
What's next?
That's well, yeah, there you go. Well, if you don't live in Washington State like Rob and I do, and you're not pumped about the Seahawks winning, then I'm sorry for you. But hey, we're going to have fun today. We are going to have a good time. I talked to Rob this week. You know, we've been doing shows on controversial issues, and we've stirred up some controversy here and there, which has been good. But I decided, hey, you know, we should do something that's not as controversial. And I don't know if we've actually accomplished that in our topic today, but we've tried. And before we get started, and I tell you what we're going to be talking about, I want to let everyone know, because of our talk last week and then several weeks before that, we talked about Paleo Hebrew and pictures being attached to letters, whether or not that was a viable way to use a hermeneutic and all that kind of stuff. I mentioned, I think last week or the week before, I mentioned that we were going to try to get Dr. Michael Brown, to come on the show. He has his degree. I believe it's in Semitic languages. I could be wrong on that, though. I should probably look that up.
I think that's right.
So, but he's got his PhD in language, in Semitic languages, I believe. And so I wanted him to come on the show and talk about Paleo Hebrew, whether or not, you know, we can use a hermeneutic where you know, pictures are attached to letters, and whether or not that can influence our hermeneutic and all that kind of stuff. He agreed to come on the show, yes, and he will be on the show on February 20th. So we're looking forward to that. To be completely honest with everyone, I have not actually talked to Dr. Brown about this. I'm going into this totally with the assumption that he will take our side, on this argument, but I could be wrong on that. Maybe he'll tell us that, you know, he interprets his whole Bible through the picture letters. Who knows? Another fun thing to look forward to is that Dr. Martin Abegg has also agreed to come on to the Rob and Caleb Show, and that's going to happen hopefully sometime. It might actually happen the week after Dr. Brown is on the program. So we got some really exciting guests that are going to be with us, and I'm actually really excited for both of those.
Insert celebratory sounds here. That's what I'm thinking. Like, yay!
Like this? Uh-huh. Okay.
There you go.
Yes.
That's right. Because this is really cool that we're going to have Dr. Brown and Dr. Abegg coming shortly. It's like, wow.
Yeah. You know, I don't necessarily, obviously, you know, Dr. Brown is, I'm not sure what denomination he is, but he's a Christian believer. And so we would disagree on some things. We're actually not going to talk about those things that we disagree with Dr. Brown in terms of, you know, keeping Torah and that kind of thing. Dr. Brown grew up, I believe, in an Orthodox home and then found the Lord. And he's quite a prolific writer. He's got his own radio program. He wrote a great series. I actually have only one of the, I think there's five volumes. My dad has all of them, called Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. He has a radio program called In the Line of Fire. He has quite an active Twitter account and writes numerous articles on a regular basis. He's a very big advocate against gay marriage and is quite eloquent on the subject and has spoken on many national radio and TV programs about that and abortion and all sorts of other things. So I'm looking forward for sure to that. And we can't wait to have Dr. Brown on this show. We hope that you're looking forward to it as well. And of course, we can't underplay Dr. Abag.
Not at all.
If you don't know, Dr. Abag is probably one of the leading Dead Sea Scroll scholars in the world today. He is at Trinity Western University. Is that right? Trinity Western?
I think so.
Yeah, in Vancouver.
It's the one up there in
Vancouver.
Langley or something.
Yeah, that's right. And he has done some amazing work. I think that pretty much anyone who's ever been interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls probably has a copy of a book that he co-authored on the translation of the Dead Sea Scrolls on their shelf. And, yeah, we're looking forward to that as well. We're actually going to talk a little bit about something that he's going to be able to shed light on. We're going to talk about that today. And that's 4QMMT. We're going to talk just a little bit about that because today, I will not leave you in suspense. Today, we are going to be talking about the issue or the debate between Dr. John Piper and Dr. N.T. Wright. And I'm sure that many of you have either bought the book or have seen the books between Dr. Wright and Dr. Piper. Dr. Wright, well, actually, let's start with Dr. Piper. Dr. Piper wrote a book, and help me with the name of this, Rob. It's The Story of Justification.
The future of Justification.
That's what it is. The Future of Justification. And he wrote that kind of as a response to many things that have been written by Dr. N.T. Wright. And Dr. N.T. Wright responded to that book. He responded with a book called Justification. A lot of people are not happy about that debate. And if you're one of those people, you can tell us about it. You can send us an email, radio@TorahResource.com, or you can follow us and comment to us on Twitter. Rob Van Hoff is at Rob Van Hoff, two F's in Van Hoff, and I am at Caleb Hegg, two G's in Hegg. So if you want to weigh in on this debate, please go ahead and do so. You can also post some comments on our Torah Resource Radio blog and find the page under Broadcast the Rob and Caleb Show, and then you can leave comments on that page in response to this broadcast. Okay, so let's talk about Dr. Wright and Dr. Piper. What is the debate? What is going on here? Why are they talking about justification? And I'm going to basically take the role of the ignorant person who knows nothing about this. And one reason I'm taking that role is because although I have studied this topic, I am quite ignorant to the topic in general. I'm still quite unclear on a lot of what the debate is between Dr. Piper and Dr. Wright. And I'm hoping that Rob Van Hoff, being the scholar that he is, can shed some light on this topic. So I know, let's first talk a little bit about the new perspective on Paul, because I think this does weigh in on the issue of what's going on here.
And yeah, and you know, that's a good place to start, Caleb. Sometimes you'll see it encoded NPP. You know, we have all these articles and books you start reading. You know, go to for example, the ETS/SBL every year, mm-hmm. and you've got millions of books, it seems like, you know.
Well, and tons of lectures, too. There's people every single year at the I'll give a little bit of history of what I know about the new perspective on Paul, and then maybe you can either tweak my understanding or shed some light on what I'm not seeing. So what I understand about the new perspective on Paul was it basically broke through in the late 70s, and it was presented at the SBL, the Society of Biblical Literature, by E.P. Sanders, another scholar who's, I wouldn't say, well, would I say friends? Colleagues for sure with Dr. Wright. They both taught at Oxford, I believe. Anyway, so E.P. Sanders wrote a paper and used the title New Perspective on Paul. He wasn't the first to do so. I believe N.T. Wright was. But basically what I understand the New Perspective on Paul to be, and I know that there's different facets of the New Perspective. I know that there's different beliefs on what the New Perspective is. But in general, what I understand the New Perspective on Paul to be is that when the old perspective would be that Paul in Romans and in other books was teaching that against the Judaisms of his day, which said that there was salvation through works. You kept the Torah and that brought you salvation. And what the New Perspective on Paul is saying is, no, that's not correct. What was actually happening in the first century Judaisms was that they were saying you were in by ethnicity. That if you were born Jewish, you were quote unquote saved. You got in. And if you weren't Jewish by blood, if you weren't circumcised on the eighth day, then you weren't in, but you could get in. You could get in by a conversion to Judaism. And so Paul was actually speaking against salvation by ethnicity and saying, no, that's not right. And also with the New Perspective, they would say that the Judaisms of the first century said you were in if you were Jewish, but there were things that you could do. There were sins you could do to become out. So tell me if I got that right, Rob.
I think that's a good framework for understanding. Of course, you interview any one of the scholars from either of these camps,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to qualify their positions, right? I mean, they're going to add subtle details and nuances to help refine their stance. That's good. You know, I mean, that's to be expected. But I think generally the big umbrella that you've painted is true. And one of the problems is that the what we call the old perspective versus the new perspective, each having, you know, different groups on each side underneath the bigger banner. The old perspective is typically consists of those who come from the Reformed tradition,
mm-hmm.
who want to make sure that they're not straying from doctrines hammered out by the Reformers, such as the imputation of righteousness,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Because the fear is that if I attribute salvation to my works, I can't. That's not an option. That there's no way I can, and so there's a threat that those people who we would call New Perspective, when they say no, Paul's not really arguing against a Judaism that believed that they could earn God's favor through deeds, that it sounds like a classical reformer viewpoint that the New Perspective person's pulling the rug out from the idea that you can, in fact, earn your righteousness before God.
Well, and
but you have, and it's kind of tricky to go back and forth like that. But the New Perspective, generally, you have like James Dunn, or N.T. Wright. They're not suggesting that you can earn your righteousness before God, at least from the way they understand and articulate their understanding. They're not saying that.
Okay, now
it seems like those of the Reformed tradition, like Piper, feel like that's what they are indeed saying.
Okay, and that's important because I can already hear people yelling at their radios or their computers or their iPhones right now, saying no, that's wrong. We're going to talk more about this, and we're going to get into semi-Pelagianism. N.T. Wright has been accused time and time again of being a semi-Pelagianist, and I think that's a word. I could be wrong. Semi-Pelagianist? Anyway, and, you know, we joked in the office. Many of you know that I last month we ran an interview that I did with Dr. N.T. Wright. And before I conducted that interview, we made some jokes. Oh, yeah, you should ask him, you know, like the question, what's the new perspective on Paul? Or you should ask him, you know, what? So really, what's the difference between, you know, what's the debate between you and Piper, which is obviously way too in depth to answer in an hour long interview, let alone, you know, maybe even a day lecture. So but let's talk. OK, so what you just said, I want to hone in on this just a little bit, because I personally would say that I do hold to certain, and we're not here to try what we're not. We're not going to try in this hour or in this program to try to convince anyone one way or the other of the new perspective on Paul. That's not the intention of this broadcast and this discussion. I would say that I hold to some of the new perspective on Paul. I do believe that the prevailing view in the first century was that the Judaisms were teaching salvation by ethnicity and not necessarily salvation by works. What do you feel about that, Rob?
Well, I add my own new, you know, just like all of us who study out these things, we tend to chew on them and reflect and compare and start to articulate, you know, our own refinement of the great work done by both Piper and Wright, for example.
And both Piper and Wright are both monsters. Piper and Wright are both theological monsters in the theological world. So kudos to both of them. I think that we should first say that we're not taking necessarily one side or the other as more just looking at the two different sides right now. Both scholars have good points, and both scholars are definitely worthy to be listened to in certain areas because of their expertise. However,
here's an example of someone who's got a major theological voice that is a little bit ambiguous. For example, I have in front of me both John Piper's book, The Future of Justification, okay, a response to N.T. Wright, mm-hmm, and the book by N.T. Wright that came out, I think the Piper's book was 2007, and then N.T. Wright's Justification, 2009.
That's right. There's
you know how you flip over a book and there's quotes from different scholars on the back?
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain person, Dr. Daryl Bach, who happens to have a citation on both books.
and who I've actually interviewed for Torah Resource Radio.
Yeah,
we'll be playing his interview in a couple months.
He's a prominent professor of the New Testament, Dallas Theological Seminary. He's also ethnically Jewish.
And is he on the board of Chosen People Ministry?
Yeah. So he's someone who has chewed on this material. But listen to Daryl Bach's, first of all, 2007, John Piper's book, he writes on the back, quote, Piper's look at justification does this with a superb tone and a careful presentation of his case. Piper has put us in a position to hear both sides of the debate and understand what is at stake. Be prepared to be sharpened by a careful dialogue about what justification is. End quote. Now, it's kind of noncommittal. It's saying, uh-huh, let's listen to what this guy says. He's going to get us thinking a little more carefully. Now, 2 years later, he has a quote on the back of N.T. Wright's book. Quote, frank theological table talk is sometimes a necessary endeavor. Tom Wright's justification is his substantive reply to critical work by many, including John Piper, on the new perspective. ... So I recommend this book and say, pull up a chair to the table and pay careful attention to the conversation. In the dialogue, all of us will learn more about what Paul and Scripture say about justification and a few other things as well. End quote.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have Dr. Bach with a quote recommending both books and not committing to a side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Saying, okay, here, we're in uncharted territory. He's not communicating. I don't know what his personal opinion is because he doesn't give it on both. He's advocating, you know, he's saying read both these books and that it's an important conversation. But I'm glad you mentioned the first, you know, E.P. Sanders, of course, his big book in the 70s was Paul and Palestinian Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
And Piper rejects a lot of Sanders' basic assumptions. And since NT Wright seems to lean on it heavily, that's one of the places of division. But here's the thing. If you read a lot of the Reformed, you know, Crossway seems to be a publisher that advocates Pipers and other such positions that are pro-Reform, anti-New Perspective. And one of the things that I'm seeing in reading these different authors, they feel threatened by the New Perspective on particularly the issue of first century Judaism, or defining whatever that means, because once you try to take Paul, which is what the New Perspective tries to do, is to take Paul and understand him in terms of the Judaisms of the world of that day, and you start looking to sources such as the Dead Sea Scrolls and all this other stuff, you start to describe Paul in terms of that historical context, and it flattens him. Now all of a sudden the gospel's not so special. The anti or the old perspective people seem to say, what you're doing now, you're just reading Paul just like it's just a first century text, and now he's just in the context of Judaism. Now it's known, and now it's not this radical declaration of the messiahship of Yeshua. Mm-hmm. And they don't like that. They really need it to be a radically new message.
But I would argue as someone who I would say that I hold to a good amount of the New Perspective, I would argue that in Paul's day, the idea of saying just because you're ethnically Jewish doesn't mean you're in, that you need the Messiah, was a radical new doctrine. That was blowing the minds of, you know, that people were ready to pick up pitchforks and run after him. Wouldn't you agree?
But see, here's the thing. The New Perspective tends to say that there is no law-gospel antithesis. In other words, Paul's not really talking against the Torah. He's talking against the way the Torah has been taken.
And that's the rub.
And twisted by the sinful nature of man, not against the Torah in of itself. Well, the old perspective on Paul doesn't like that, because the... some of the old perspective people want to see an antithesis between mm-hmm. law and gospel, like they're opposites.
Shameless plug, if you want to know the difference between law and grace and how we at Torah Resource would work that passage out where Paul talks about you're no longer under law but under grace, there's a great new teaching by my father, Tim Haig. You can find it on the website. It's called Law versus Grace. Keep going, Rob.
Well, another aspect of this, with this, in other words, the Jewish background to Paul, for example, that someone like Piper shies away from even thinking about things like that. Whereas Wright wants to say, no, let's look at history. We don't have anything to be afraid of. Let's look at the text. And so I lean with Piper or with Wright on that front. Now I don't agree with all of Wright says, I don't agree with all the Piper says, because I have my own little pet nuances. But and we can chat about those. But if we go back to these books, this The Future of Justification by Piper, and then the initial response by Wright, Justification, one of the other issues of division is that N.T. Wright, and he did this back probably in the 80s and 90s, he talked about the Hebrew law court, he understood God's righteousness within a context of covenant and what he calls like the Hebrew law court or the Torah law court. Whereas Piper rejects Wright's definition of the righteousness of God as being defined within the context of covenant or law court. And rather, Piper says, no, the righteousness of God is God's unswerving commitment to act in accordance with his own glory, and God doesn't have a rule book he has to abide by.
Okay,
he just upholds his own infinite value of glory and holiness. And
okay,
that's what God's righteousness is.
Hang on now, for our listeners, this is now getting to the core of the issue of justification. If you have been wondering why we're talking about the New Perspective on Paul up until this point, now. Rob, what I hear you doing is moving towards the actual core issue of justification between Piper and Wright. And that is the difference between the righteousness of God. Am I correct on where you're kind of going with this?
Yeah, and that's where it, and basically the reason that's tied in my view, with this new perspective of Paul type of controversy, is because that's where the rubber meets the road. In other words, it's so in other words, the Piper, you know, let's say he's just the old school Reformed Calvinist. He hears someone coming and talking about, you know, the Jewish background of the New Testament. We can actually, Paul was saying something different than what the Reformed, classic Reformers were saying. Piper says, okay, well, where does the rubber meet the road? Oh, you mean that. And it comes to this idea of justification. How are we justified? How is the believer, the one in Christ or in Messiah, justified before God? And that's right at the...
That's at the very core of it, yeah. Okay, so now let's just come at it head on. In your opinion, and then we'll talk. We'll hash it out after this. But I like asking these direct questions, and then figuring out how you get there. In your opinion, what is the direct difference between Piper and Wright on that subject? When we talk about the righteousness of God, where does it split? What's the debate now?
Well, first off, when we talk about the righteousness of God, we're talking about primarily Romans and how to interpret key passages from Paul that talk about the righteousness of God.
Okay.
And then how the person in Messiah become righteous.
Okay.
So we're not dealing with just this abstract idea of the righteousness of God. We're actually talking about the way Piper and Wright would approach specific passages.
So how a believer is justified and thus gains salvation through God and through God's righteousness. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay.
And so basically we're dealing with the same text, but what happens is Piper wants to say that God's righteousness is not defined by a context of covenant, that it's defined just by God acting in accordance with his own nature, which is not dependent or it doesn't have to answer to any outside.
So let me see if I can break that down. Let me see if I can. So what you just said, I want to see if I can re-say it and tell me if I'm right on this. So what you're saying is Piper's argument is that God's righteousness, God is fully righteous. That's all there is to it. God is righteous. He, you know, one line of thought could be he wrote the Torah. He made what is righteous, what is holy. Therefore, he's purely holy.
Exactly. And it could be merciful. It could be righteous. It could be
anything. That's
you know,
what
just,
he
just any of these words that it just has to do with God's own character.
Okay, well, that sounds right, doesn't it?
Now, let's look at Wright's view.
Okay,
Wright's
now let's look at Wright's view. Yeah.
Wright's view says, wait a minute. We can't... While Piper would grab certain passages from, let's say, the Psalms or things that kind of are these poetic ways of talking about God's holiness, Wright would say, yes, but what we have to look at is in the case where first century Judaism. Now, all of a sudden, now we're getting into history and the worldviews of Jews in the first century. And this is where Piper is not happy going because he's not happy with this idea of this new perspective on Paul, putting Paul in this first century context. But that's where Wright wants to take us. And he says, look, people, you know, not every Jew, we don't know what every Jew was doing. We don't know what, quote, Judaism was doing or believed, but we can look at extant texts. You know, what text do we have? It looks like different Jewish groups were calculating, looking at Daniel, and they were thinking that they were in the end times. They were trying to calculate when the Messiah was going to come.
Just they like believed, today.
What's that? Yeah.
Just
they
like
believed,
today.
They yeah. believed that they were, this was the time where God was going to, that, you know, they believed that they had lived under the curses, that the Greeks had oppressed them. Now the Roman occupation was just unbearable. You had all sorts of political chaos and problem with the nations of the world trying to take away the Torah, as with like the Maccabean story, etc. And there was this sense of God is going to come through on his promises. He promised he would restore us per the end of Deuteronomy, where it says, you know, these curses will be on you, but there will be blessing if you return and seek me with your whole heart. And even though that in one sense the exile was thought to be over because the Jews had returned to the land and built the second temple, etc. There was this ongoing sense, Wright argues, that the exile still had not fully been over. There were still Jews all across the world from Babylon all the way to maybe as far as, well, we know as far as Rome.
Okay, hang on just a sec, Rob. Now, I remember this part of Wright's book because I've read both books, The Future of Justification and Wright's Justification.
Yeah,
correct me if I'm wrong, but Wright actually brings that even farther. He brings the exile into today, that the exile still continues on until the Messiah comes. Is that correct?
I believe so. I believe he ultimately wants to go there. But in terms of dividing with Piper, it's really on the scene of first century.
Okay.
And so God's righteousness, N.T. Wright wants to argue, is when Paul's talking about that in the first century, he's talking about a common Jewish belief for those pious Jews who believed in the story of Israel and longed to see the redemption and that believed that God was going to come through on his promises, that the righteousness of God meant God's vindication of Israel in the eyes of all these nations that had rejected him and had oppressed his people. And so that's what Wright puts under the larger framework as a Hebrew court situation.
Okay, so let me see.
Where you have, in the prophets, you have, you know, this idea of a complaint. Like Israel issues a complaint before God because these nations are oppressing him and that God is going to then justify Israel and he's going to punish the enemy. And it goes all the way back to the Torah, the idea that you'd have a judge who hears out a case. And then so he has, you know, someone with an accusation and then the accused in front of him. And then understanding the word tzedakah or tzedek is
righteousness.
Yeah, righteousness is dependent on understanding that system, that you have a judge and you have the accuser and the accused in front of the judge. The judge makes a ruling and then that's it. And then the case is over, case closed. One person leaves that courtroom a tzaddik or righteous, and the other a resha, a wicked or a wrong, the person who was not vindicated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me see if I can actually try to explain in my own words what you just said, so that we can try to understand this argument. So, John Piper is saying, Dr. Piper, is it Dr. Piper? Yeah, Dr. Piper is saying that God is righteous because he created everything. So he created righteousness, essentially, and therefore he is fully righteous. Everything that's not righteous deviates from him. Whereas what Wright is saying is that, yes, God is righteous, but that's not what Paul was talking about. In Romans and in the rest of the quote-unquote argument, what Paul is talking about is God's righteousness through the covenant, i.e., when we talk about God's righteousness in the Pauline letters and the epistles and all those kind of things, what we're actually talking is God's faithfulness and, i.e., righteousness to the covenants that were given in Torah. Am I correct on that?
Yeah. And testified about in the Torah. And, for example, because there will be a distinction between, like in Galatians, between the promise and then the Torah, which came later, like the promise to Abraham. But the reason this is important for Wright, from N.T. Wright's perspective, is that there was a reason why Paul is saying, you are Abraham's children and heirs according to the promise. In other words, to be a son of Abraham meant something in terms of story. In other words, Caleb, let's say you're a Gentile, you hear this word of the gospel, you believe it, and then I'm telling you this, you believe it, and I say, and you are now a son of Abraham, that means you have a new story. You're part of this story that goes all the way back to Abraham.
And we know that God will be righteous to his covenant.
And there's covenant in there.
Yeah.
That's
okay.
And so Wright wants to say there's a reason why Paul is insisting that these believers are sons of Abraham. Because there's a covenant context to the gospel message it's promise and it's covenant in terms of that it's the type of covenant of God's promise with Abraham, is a covenant. It's not the same as the covenant of Sinai, of course. But the covenant of Sinai has to also be understood inside in terms of the Abrahamic covenant, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. But in any case, that there's a story there that the believer now is a part of. They are part of that story, and that covenant faithfulness is what's meant by God's righteousness. Now, Piper has a view. Piper is not interested, for some reason, at least in what I've read of him, in understanding God's righteousness in terms of the covenant history.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, he just defines God's righteousness as in really abstract terms, like, oh, well, it's God's zealous activity that always accords and forever accords with his own ultimate glory.
Okay.
Because he is the most important, most highly valued thing in the universe. He actually uses that kind of term. And all of a sudden we're talking about God with these abstract terms, but we're not talking about covenant. But the irony here is the only reason we have what Piper calls the Old Testament over and over again that he refers to justify his definition, the very Old Testament, the very Tanakh, we only have it because of the covenant. You know, we only have the scriptures because of the covenant.
Okay, so, you know, and I believe that this argument actually comes down into, you know, people might start seeing this somewhat of a, you know, in the mainstream Christian view, since covenant, you know, those covenants have been done away with. Now we're in the new covenant, so the other covenants don't matter. Whereas a lot of the messianic view of the covenants is, no, that's not right. The new covenant works in concert with the other covenants. And that's a little bit where I see N.T. Wright coming from. Not that Wright would say that we need to keep all of Torah. He doesn't say that. In fact, he would
and
say...
And that's where we get into MMT. And I know there's... I realize that all these things are...
Okay,
are
and we're going to...
Separate issues, but they're...
That's right. Hang on. We're going to talk about 4Q MMT from the Dead Sea Scrolls and what light that might shed on this subject. We're also going to talk about semi-Pelagianism. That's right. Recently online, I have been told that if you believe in the New Perspective on Paul, you believe in semi-Pelagianism. What does that mean? And why would someone accuse people who believe in the New Perspective on Paul to be semi-Pelagianism? Or semi-Pelagianists, I guess I should say. We'll talk about all of that when we come back.
You're listening to The Rob and Caleb Show.
That's right. You are listening to The Rob and Caleb Show. Welcome back. We're talking about the difference, or the debate, rather, between Dr. John Piper and Dr. N.T. Wright, both amazing scholars in their own rights. And so we've hashed out a little bit about what we believe the actual debate is. And I'm just going to real quick mention that Piper would say that righteousness of God and the way that we're justified, therefore, is through God's righteousness, i.e. being that God is righteous because that's what he is. He is fully righteous. He made Torah. He made everything. He is righteous. And Wright would say that might be true. However, what Paul is talking about is not God's righteousness in that sense. What N.T. Wright is saying, Paul is saying, is that when it's talking about righteousness, we're talking about God's faithfulness to the covenants, i.e. God's righteousness.
Yeah, and Caleb, real quick, if I could add a nuance that I realized we didn't touch on very clearly in the last half, is that where this... to really bring this home, it has to do with the idea of whose righteousness is given to the believer. In other words, N.T. Wright would say in the court model, the Hebrew law court model of righteousness, that the judge has his own righteousness. The judge's righteousness is defined by the Torah as a judge who will not accept a bribe. He's not going to favor the poor over the wealthy, or the wealthy over the poor. He's not going to show favoritism. He's going to hear a matter out, and mm-hmm. he's going to rule accordingly. And that's what a righteous judge does.
Okay.
And then there's a separate righteousness in the court model, the law court, is that the ruling that the judge gives after hearing the matter, and he gives a ruling, he declares one of the parties righteous, and that person then leaves the courtroom with an official legal status of righteous. However, his legal status has been declared by a righteous judge. It's not that the judge took anything that was the judge's and gave it to that person. It was rather a ruling of a righteous judge.
Okay,
so it's declarative. Now, Piper rejects that view.
Now, I'm going to take Piper's side on this for a few seconds, and let's see how we can hash this out. So, isn't it that Yeshua's righteousness? You know, he was the perfect lamb that was slain. So we receive Yeshua's righteousness. Doesn't that make us righteous?
But the question is how is that accredited to us? Wright wants to argue that it's in the Hebrew, what he calls the, quote, Hebrew law court model, where the judge didn't give me yes, God is righteous. He's not going to be bribed. He doesn't favor, you know, he's no respecter of persons. He knows the end from, he knows all the facts. He renders, Wright will say, that Yeshua's resurrection is basically the vindication, ultimate vindication of the righteous person. That Yeshua rose from the dead is, like Paul says at the beginning of Romans, by the resurrection of the dead, he's basically declared that is the full expression of Yeshua's vindication as just. In other words, Judgment Day, in one respect, according to Wright, has happened at the death and resurrection of Yeshua. That all the powers of darkness came and made accusations against the Son of God, and that Yeshua was found righteous in the heavenly court.
Okay.
And that his resurrection is because death could not hold him, because death has no legal, there was no covenantal legal angle by which death could hold Yeshua. So thus his resurrection and subsequent eternal life, and that is not different. Yeshua's resurrection is not to be understood as somehow separate from his vindication or the declaration of righteousness, of his righteousness. Now that's Yeshua's real righteousness. And so Wright would say that is not the righteousness of the judge necessarily. In other words, the judge made the declaration and then Yeshua's vindicated. All claims against him in this heavenly court scene that Wright wants us to imagine, all accusations are found, I don't know if you use law terms, unconvincing or not convincing.
Okay,
they have no substance.
Okay, so maybe I'm not understanding then, because what you're saying, Wright is saying, is that the righteousness of Yeshua is not accredited to us? Is that what I'm hearing you saying?
No, well, let me finish. Then those who are in Yeshua then participate in that, in his life, in his resurrection life, in his righteousness becomes our righteousness because we're in him. We are declared, if we are in him, we share that same verdict.
I see.
But what Wright wants to say is that it's not the judge's righteousness that somehow the judge took from him and then gives to us. That's what Wright wants to say, that's not a completely accurate way it accomplishes the same. We get to the same place, but Wright doesn't like. He says that that's a
not the
not
way to get
accurate
there.
Way of describing it.
I see. Okay,
but then Piper takes issue. Piper says, "No, we can't use this court model. This court model is inadmissible. We can't just use first century Judaism's to try to understand the background because we're dealing with scripture here. And but that God actually did take some of his own righteousness. God took his righteousness and imputes it, gives it. It's an alien righteousness that we didn't have and gives it to us. And that there's an exchange where they take takes our sin away. Mm. Puts it on Christ. Christ gives us his righteousness in an exchange.
Okay.
And that now we have, instead of our sin, Yeshua took our sin and gave us his righteousness, and that that's the way to look at it. And it has nothing to do with a law court.
Okay, so Piper's just taking, essentially, he's just taking the common Christian stance of justification.
I would say so to something, you know. Now, I would be the first to say I am not an expert by any means in all the dispute, you know, in the Reformation, you know, mm-hmm. all the different nuances to justification. I lean heavily, you know, on scholars like your father for that type of thing. I'm just trying to represent the dispute between Piper and Wright as I understand it.
Okay.
The reason I lean towards right in this is because I think in terms of John 15, Yeshua says, apart from me, you can do nothing, and that he is the vine and we are the branches. In other words, I don't see it, and I've seen R.C. Sproul present it this way too. I don't see it that I am some separate individual, and then Yeshua took my sin away and then gave me his righteousness, and I'm still some separate bubble. And that's what I have problem with that portrayal, and I've seen that written in different diagrams. Rather, I see it as the grafting, is that I've been attached. I am attached to the vine. I am a branch of the vine, and then I become pruned as I grow and mature to bring with and that's what. That's what the Father does, is he prunes us and grooms us so that we bring more glory to him, that we bring more fruit of the Spirit into the world and participate in that joy, but that we are not an independent entity anymore. Our life comes from our attachment to the vine, our grafting into the tree, however you want to think of that. That I'm not this separate thing now with my own life. I am a completely new creation, and the life that I have, the very life that I have, is Yeshua's life. That I can't, if I imagine myself separate from him, I'm not going to produce anything for the kingdom.
Okay, so let's shift gears now just a little bit. We've been talking about the difference between and the argument between Piper and Dr. Wright. So let's move now to a couple of different aspects of this. I want to move to first 4QMMT of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then after that I want to quickly move to semi-Pelagianism, which is a giant subject in and of itself. We could probably do an entire show on Pelagianism and the difference between an Arminian viewpoint and a Calvinistic viewpoint. And so we'll talk about that in a few seconds, but let's first look at 4QMMT and how that might relate to this this discussion. Why would this Dead Sea Scroll even shed any light on this?
That's a great question. And then here we're, you know, all these issues I know are so, there's a lot been written on each one of these facets that we're discussing here. And I know that it might be frustrating to our listeners. The 4QMMT is just a code word for the name of a document found at Qumran in, like, I think 6 different copies. So we know that there were 6 different copies, and some of the copies have some of the parts missing.
And they're dated to what, 100 to 200 years before the coming of the Messiah?
Yeah, 100, maybe 100 BC, okay, yeah. Roughly.
I think 100, 150 BC, yeah.
they're in different scribal hands, if I remember right. So in other words, we know that it was copied and used in different generations and referred to. It wasn't so there's a history there that is not entirely clear.
But let's explain this just a little bit more for
our
listeners.
But the significance is that...
Hang on just a second. Let's explain this just a little bit more for our listeners, because 4QMMT is not a canonical book. It's not something that you can find in your scriptures today. You can't open the Bible and find the document, you know, this document in your Bible. 4QMMT was basically the community rule. Am I correct on that?
Well, it's... to be clear, the community rule, or in Hebrew, the Serach HaYichad, is a separate document that has to do with the covenantal rules and, you know, procedures for the Yichad community, which is what they call them, the Yichad.
Okay,
the,
so explain for a few seconds then 4QMMT and how that relates to the community.
It's a similar type of document, except it seems to be a letter. In matter of fact, early on it was called the Halakhic letter.
Okay.
And it's a letter that has a bunch of rules. I think Marty Abig says there's about 24 different rules that are not, they're based on written Torah, much of them, but they are specific halachot, or this is what you do here, and if you do this, this is wrong, and you need to do it this way. It's very specific instructions on how certain commandments are to be kept, and that this is the only way to do it.
So almost
the other ways are wrong.
Almost like oral, almost like the oral tradition or the oral Torah that we would have today in terms of like the Mishnah or the Talmud the Tosefta,
exactly.
But except it was way earlier.
It doesn't agree with Pharisaic Halakha or what the later rabbi. So it's a similar type of situation, let's say, with the Mishnah, except it's they
for
have
the
different,
Essenes.
It's different perspective on things.
It's for the Essenes, a different sect of Judaism.
So in any case, well, whether or not they don't call themselves the Essenes. So we know that Josephus talks about the Essenes, and it might very well be. But in terms of themselves, they call themselves the true Israel.
Okay.
So in any case, MMT is the reason they call it MMT is from the Hebrew Miksat Maaseh HaTorah, which means the a few works of the law. And so this is the only other that, and this is the significance of this text, is that it's the only place outside of Galatians, outside of Paul, that uses this phrase "works of the law," and it's in Hebrew, and it has very specific Jewish context in the Second Temple period. So Wright thinks, you know, we need to really try to understand what this phrase "works of the law" is,
and how it's used in the first century,
because it's going to help us understand what Paul means by "works of the law."
Okay,
that's there again. Though we have that's the new perspective, on Paul philosophy creeping in. Okay, we can use first century sources to help us understand
other
these
first century
ambiguities within Paul. Well, Piper will say, you know, he'd put the yellow flag up. You know, slow down, buddy. We can't. It's too hard to understand. We're not going to be able to really understand what those documents mean. There's just too much uncertain. We need to stick to Scripture, and we can't really refer to these other things because we have no idea whether Paul meant it the same way. Da 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 da. So you have a divide over the method of how is the, and it's similar to how we might say in one Torah communities, how do we use rabbinic writings to help us understand the Gospels? Well, from broad brushstrokes, it might look similar, but with rabbinic texts, we're talking about
stuff way
quite
later.
A difference in time. Yeah, you know, rabbi's stuff comes way later. It's definitely post Gospels and is a response to Gospels in many ways. Whereas this is a context for Paul. This is actually older than Paul's quote of works of the law, and seems to lend insight. But so as far as Piper will go, well, Piper will just say, well, works of the law in Paul means just doing the commandments, doing the commandments. You can't be saved by doing the commandments. That's what Piper's bottom line is. Wright says that's true. You can't, no one could be saved by doing the commandments, but that's not what Paul's getting at right here. When he talks about works of the law, what Paul's we're getting at is something close to this Qumran document that has to do with things that separate Jews from Gentiles, like Sabbath, circumcision, dietary laws.
Okay.
And that he's, like you mentioned, ethnicity. What Paul's saying, well, So, in other words, Wright agrees with Piper. Yeah, you can't. You're not going to impress God. You know, mm-hmm. you're not going to earn God's favor. But that's not what Paul's saying here. Wright will say. Wright says, rather, Paul is saying, trying to distinguish yourself as Jewish is not going to give you saved by doing Sabbath and circumcision and dietary laws. That's what Paul means by works of the law, not just doing commandments generally, but specific those works of the law are those things that separated Jews from Gentiles. And that's okay. what Christ came to do away with. Okay, now, so they both differ on what Paul means by works of the law. Now enter Marty Abeg, who you are going to have the opportunity to chat with. I don't know.
We are. Awesome. Well, he's coming on our show. It's going to be you and me,
sure
buddy.
If that was a separate interview, or well, that's going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's going
to
be fun.
I look forward to that. But in any case, Marty Abeg wants to add new. He challenges Wright's interpretation.
Okay.
And Marty Abeg says in one of his articles that I think is great. He says, now, N.T. Wright, and they're back and forth. They've had conversations. He puts in his footnotes of this one particular article how they had email back and forth. You know, so this is all on the up and up. Abeg says, well, while Wright says that the works of the law are those things like dietary laws, circumcision, Sabbath, things that separate Jew from Gentile, Marty Abeg wants to say, no, that's not what works of the law is. What works of the law is more akin to what you see today in denominationalism within, let's say, American Christianity as a whole. Like, why Baptists are different than some other group. And you go and you see all the minutiae of doctrinal positions that separate one brand of Christianity from another brand of Christianity. And that's more analogous to what was going on with works of the law in the first century. And the difference is, for Wright needs works of the law to mean separation, things that separate Jew from Gentile. Where Abeg says, no, it's things that separated Jew from Jew.
Mm, okay.
In other words, true Israel from those other Jews that don't have it right.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Even though they're Jew.
I see how that would work out, especially in the Qumran text, why that would be a big deal. Because
and Abeg's just bringing and that's just exactly what they were doing at the Yakad, the Qumran. They were saying, distinguishing themselves from other Jews. They weren't really worried about the nations of the world so much. They were saying, no, we have it right. We have the right understanding of Torah, and all of any from Judah that do not follow our ways are going to be lost.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a Jew/Jew issue.
Yeah.
That's what works of the law is, not Jew-Gentile issue. Wright wants it to be a Jew-Gentile issue, and then Piper wants it to be a humankind issue.
Yeah,
man can't ever earn his way. So works of the law just means doing anything to try to earn your right before God.
Very broad strokes on that.
My concern is this. If we were to ever be able to talk to Piper about the one Torah perspective, I think he would think we're crazy.
Yeah.
He would think he would... I don't know for a fact, but it would seem that if he sees people keeping the Shabbat and doing what we would call, you know, biblical, to the best of our ability, a biblical diet and, you know, feast days, et cetera, circumcision, et cetera, that I think my understanding of Piper's position, that would be seen as totally misunderstanding radical new world that there is post-resurrection.
Well, and
I think Wright might think along the same lines.
Well, I think that Piper takes the what I would consider the common Christian viewpoint. You know, I not only do I know people, but I'm related to people who think that I'm quite insane and that I've misinterpreted Paul, and you know, think that the new perspective on Paul is also quite insane. So I think that Piper's taking what I would consider the mainstream Christian view on justification, the new perspective on Paul, works of the law, all these kind of things. Whereas N.T. Wright is kind of taking a new, and you know, if you heard that interview with Wright, he uses the rewords. We call them the rewords: refresh, renew, You know, he's taking a renewed look at the way Paul is interpreted. Let's move now. I want to move for a second to semi-Pelagianism. So we're going to talk about this now. Basically, this is going to speak on a number of different issues. I'm going to try to wrap up what the argument is of, or what semi-Pelagianism is as a whole. First, which this is a huge issue. It's not, I mean, we could take a whole show and talk about this. So basically, this is going to, Pelagianism was a very old theology. It was deemed a heresy. Basically, it also speaks to Arminianism versus Calvinism. And that is that a person has some form of, ability to help in their own salvation, i.e., God makes us righteous up until this point, and then we basically have to take care of it from the time we accept Christ on. Now, help me out on that, Rob. I mean, what am I missing in that? Because there, I'm missing something.
Well, I'm not sure what you're missing. I think that there might be different kind of brands of how they say Pelagianism. It goes back to Augustine and Pelagius,
yes,
like the 4th, 5th century, I think the 5th century maybe. But the idea was that, my understanding is that it was a person, the idea that a person of their own free will would accept the gospel.
Yes.
And that rather than being chosen by God.
And so we, yeah, so and now this
and
gets...
And then of course there's details, whether or not it's semi or not, as to what happens next. Is he then responsible for all the spiritual growth subsequent to my choice?
Yeah, and this actually, the reason I bring up Arminianism juxtaposed to Calvinism is because recently I found out that there is a teacher that's quite well known, and someone told me, oh, he's an Arminianist. You know, he's Arminian in his theology. And I thought, okay, so, you know, why does that really matter? Honestly, is what I thought. Like, okay, so what? He believes that a believer can lose their salvation. Okay, so we're off on that, but who really cares? Then my father gave me a book. It's called The 5 Points of Calvinism, Defined, Defended, Documented by David N. Steele and Curtis Thomas. It is an excellent, excellent book. And honestly, that book actually kind of alerted me to why the difference is such a big deal. It is a big deal. And essentially, the reason that I believe it's such a big deal now that I've read that book is that in my mind, and someone who holds to an Arminian doctrine would say, no, we absolutely don't believe this, but I just don't see how it works out otherwise, that if you believe that you can lose your salvation, that means that you have something to do with your own salvation. And essentially, it boils down to a salvation by works. If I can lose it, that means that I have something to do with it. And I don't believe that. The Calvin view would say, no, God calls us. God, you know, we are the elect because God calls us. We're elected. He brings us to himself. He is the one who changes our heart. He is the one who brings us into salvation. We have nothing to do with it. And I would agree with that view. So the reason that we bring this up is because N.T. Wright has been accused time and time again, and basically people who believe in the New Perspective on Paul have been accused of being semi-Pelagianist, i.e. thinking that in some way we can gain our own salvation. Now, Rob, maybe you can help me out. How are people equating the New Perspective with a semi-Pelagian view?
Well, remember how we talked about the New Perspective want to portray the Judaism of Paul's day differently than John Piper wants to portray it.
Okay.
So they're painting a backdrop that's different. N.T. Wright wants to look to the sources. He leans a lot on E.P. Sanders' book, Paul and Palestinian Judaism, to suggest that the Jews, that a lot of the, seems like a lot of the Jewish groups at the time of Paul did not view themselves as earning salvation through what they did. Rather, Wright would argue, and the New Perspective on Paul generally would argue, that these Jewish groups thought that they understood that they were already in the covenant and that they were part of Israel because of God's election, not because of anything they did. But yet they believed that the Torah was given with commandments for them to live in this world in that covenant, in that election. In other words, so God elected them, not their own choice, these Jews of the first century, but rather God did give them the divine, holy, and good Torah with commandments to walk in, and that they were, these groups were attempting to define what walking in Torah means. In other words, maintaining covenant relationship, how to walk in that covenant that God put us in. So now, then that would be rights. Maybe that might be overgeneralized, but rights and Sanders, E.P. Sanders' portrayal, which is different than, say, the Lutheran and maybe some of the Reform tradition that wants to say, no, all the Jews in Paul's day or in Yeshua's day were thought that they could merit their own righteousness before God. They could earn God's favor by doing commandments and showing, you know, how pious they were by their observance of the Torah, and that's what Paul was arguing against.
Okay,
you see the two differences?
Yeah, but how does that equate into someone today? You know, why would someone then accuse N.T. Wright of being a semi-Pelagianist if because he holds to the new perspective?
Because it would say that he's hinting to the idea that, yes, sure, it's kind of the opposite. It's sure God called you in and it was God's election, but then it's on you now to keep yourself in.
I see.
The fact that there's a mix of like, yeah, so God elected you, but now you have to keep yourself in by your own works.
But I don't.
What Piper is concerned about with Wright.
But I don't hear Wright saying that. Do you?
No.
Yeah, because I think that Wright is saying that's what the Jews of the first century actually believe. That's not what he believes, though.
And I would agree with you. I don't think that that's what Wright is trying to say. However, I do, because of, you know, what Dr. Abegg's point regarding where he says that N.T. Wright could use some clarification on the work, this phrase works of the law. I think that Wright, because he has a different conception of what works of the law means, he takes it somewhere where I don't go. So while I between the Piper and Wright debate, I lean towards Wright in a lot of aspects. I am also really convinced by Dr. Abegg's work on this passage from MMT, you know, the works of the law.
Okay, so wait, hang on just a sec then. For those of you who might be listening who are saying, well, I believe that N.T. Wright is semi-Pelagian and, you know, holds to a semi-Pelagianist view and whatnot, I have one quote for you. I want to read this. We are coming to the end of our time here. But I pulled this quote out of N.T. Wright's commentary on the book of Romans, and this is on Romans 8:31 through 39. He says, this is N.T. Wright, says, whatever we think about that with verses 33 through 34, we are back in the law court, as in the middle of chapter 3. In verse 2, 1 through 16, the whole human family faced the judgment of God. In 3:19 through 20, the whole world was in the dock, with no defense to offer against massive charges. Now, we look around for possible accusers and find none. Any that might appear have to face the fact that God, the judge, is the justifier. In other words, that the verdict has already been pronounced by the judge whose righteousness has been fully displayed. And that verdict, that those in the Messiah are marked out by faith, are already to be seen as righteous, even ahead of the final vindication, is precisely what the law court dimension of justification is all about. We should note that at this point, Paul is once again speaking of the final day of judgment, as in 2:1 through 16 and 8:1. As he looks ahead to that future moment, he puts his confidence in the past event of justification, and hence the present standing of God's people that results from it, knowing that those God justified, he also glorified. The logic of justification comes full circle. So,
yeah, that's how I understand. I'm convinced by Wright's perspective with respect to the law court model.
I am too, and quite frankly, I know that there has been accusations of people who believe in the new perspective on Paul to be semi-Pelagianism to hold to a semi-Pelagianism view. I assure you, I hold to a good amount of what would be considered the new perspective on Paul. I am in no way a semi-Pelagianist, and I don't actually believe that N.T. Wright is a semi-Pelagianist in that respect either. So if you have heard anything that we've said and think that we're wrong, or if you'd like to shed some light in areas that we might have missed about this debate between John Piper and N.T. Wright, please shoot us an email, radio@TorahResource.com. You can also shoot us a tweet on Twitter. I'm at Caleb Hegg, 2 G's in Hegg, and Rob is at Rob Van Hoff, 2 F's in Van Hoff. You can also leave us a comment on the TR Radio page for the Rob and Caleb Show, which can be found at trradio.com. All right, Rob. Hey, man. I have actually learned quite a little bit about this argument that I did not know before. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Hey, you bet. Me too.
Yeah, and I'm not actually sure what we're going to be talking about next week, but the week after that, we are going to be having Dr. Michael Brown to once again talk about language and pictures being attached to letters and whether or not that's a good hermeneutic. So I do hope that you join us then. Join us next week as we find another thing to talk about that we hope and pray glorifies our great God and Savior, Yeshua the Messiah.